he looked like he always had a thin sheen of sweat covering his face. He promised his followers that he could help them achieve harmonic wealth in all areas of their life. He claimed that, using his own techniques, he'd not only gotten rich, but that he also no longer so much as caught a cold. There was clearly some sort of error in his thinking, however, because in October of 2009, at a spiritual warrior retreat in Arizona, which cost nearly 10 grand per person, three of Ray's followers died in a sweat lodge ceremony over which he personally presided. It was an imitation of a Native American ritual that Ray promised would be a rebirthing exercise. As the sweat lodge story began to gain national traction, the producers of Nightline sent me to Arizona to check it out. Sedona, a city known as the New Age Vatican, set amid dramatic red rock cliffs, was a mecca for spiritual tourists who were catered to by a legion of self-proclaimed healers, mystics, wind whisperers, and intuitive counselors who offered such services as soul retrieval, energy healing, and aura photos. The downtown shopping district echoed with the sounds of wind chimes and the low hum of didgeridoo. For me, the most pathetic part of the entire story was talking to the survivors who still claimed to believe in Ray. We went to the home of Brian Assad, an unassuming employee at an event production company. He showed us his visioning board, on which he had a picture of Alyssa Milano, who he was hoping to meet. He also showed us the books and handouts he'd collected from all the Ray retreats he'd attended. Then he revealed all the unpaid bills that were mounting on his kitchen table, bills he might have been able to pay if he hadn't given so much money to Ray. It's like right now, I don't actually have enough cash in my account to pay all these bills, so I'm just kind of putting out there that I need to attract money that I need to pay all these. After investigating for 4 months, police in Arizona charged Ray with manslaughter. The man who once told viewers of The Secret that they should treat the universe as if it were Aladdin's lamp was perp-walked in front of the cameras, wearing handcuffs and leg irons, looking mortified. Even though he'd authored a book called Harmonic Wealth, he said he didn't have enough money to make bail. In another delicious twist, investigators released documents that seemed to explain how Ray maintained his robust physical appearance. It wasn't the law of attraction. After the sweat lodge, police found a suitcase in Ray's room filled with diet supplements and prescribed steroids. That discovery in the hotel room crystallized everything that I found most absurd and hypocritical about the self-help industry. To tell the truth, it hadn't taken long for me to figure out that this scene was not for me. Luckily, with an assist from my future wife, I'd found something more promising. Chapter 5, The Jew Boo. I was back at the Tribeca Grand, the self-consciously hip hotel in downtown Manhattan where I'd stayed in the days after 9/11. The place had now been restored to its natural state with mood lighting, techno music, and well-dressed people sipping foreign beers on fluffy chairs. Hardly the environment in which I would have expected to find the kind of guru I was looking for. Until this moment, in fact, I hadn't quite realized that looking for a guru was what I'd been doing all along. The guy standing here with me at the bar certainly would not have embraced the title, which, of course, was part of his appeal. He was totally reasonable and utterly uncheesy, a man with actual credentials, including a medical degree from Harvard, which conferred a sort of legitimacy that, say, an online degree from the University of Sedona did not. His basic message was that the best self-help program was developed 2,500 years ago, a worldview that, oddly enough, held that there is actually no self to help. The seeds of this encounter had been planted one evening at home as I was changing out of my suit and tie into my sweatpants, shucking sartorial detritus, pants, socks, belt, all over the floor. I enjoyed doing this not only because it appealed to both my laziness and my constant desire to rush to the next thing. The sooner I get these clothes off, the sooner I'll get dinner. But also because it annoyed Bianca, who sometimes playfully called me Hurricane Harris. On this night, though, she was not taking the bait. She was coming at me with a gift, in fact. In her hands, she had a pair of books written by someone named Dr. Mark Epstein. She told me that after months of listening to me alternately rhapsodize or carp about Eckhart Tolle et al., it had finally clicked with her why the ideas I was yammering on about with varying levels of cogency sounded so familiar. About 10 years prior, she had read some books by Epstein, who, she explained, was a psychiatrist and a practicing Buddhist. His writing had been useful for her during a difficult time in her 20s, a quarter-life crisis when she was struggling with family issues, as well as the decision about whether to embark on the interminable training necessary to become a doctor. I flipped over one of the paperbacks to get a look at this Epstein character, and there on the back cover was a kind-faced, middle-aged guy wearing a V-neck sweater and wire-rimmed glasses, sitting on the floor against the type of white backdrop you often see in photography studios. Even though he looked infinitely less weird than either Eckhart Tolle or Deepak Chopra, I still found myself thinking, not my kind of guy. That mild, momentary spasm of aversion was assuaged by the little bio next to Epstein's picture, which said he was a trained psychiatrist with a private practice in Manhattan. Thus began another night of delayed sleep and revelatory reading, with Bianca quietly dozing by my side. It was like my first evening with Tolle, only less embarrassing. What I found in the pages of Epstein's book was thunderously satisfying, like scratching an itch in an unreachable area, like finally figuring out why Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia's sexual tension never felt right. Very quickly, it became blazingly clear the best parts of Tolle were largely unattributed Buddhism. Tolle had not, as I'd assumed when I first read A New Earth, made up his insights out of whole cloth. Apparently, he'd appropriated them and then affected a sort of intellectual elephantiasis, exaggerating their features in the most profitable of ways. 2.5 millennia before Eckhart Tolle started cashing his royalty checks, it was the Buddha who originally came up with that brilliant diagnosis of the way the mind works. In Epstein's writings, it was all there. The insatiable wanting, the inability to be present, the repetitive, relentlessly self-referential thinking. Here was everything that fascinated me about Tolle without the pseudoscience and grandiloquence. To boot, the good doctor could actually write. Compared to Tolle, in fact, this guy was Tolstoy. After months of swimming against the riptide of bathos and bullshit peddled by the self-help subculture, it was phenomenally refreshing to see the ego depicted with wry wit. We are constantly murmuring, muttering, scheming, or wondering to ourselves under our breath, wrote Epstein. I like this. I don't like that. She hurt me. How can I get that? More of this. No, more of that. Much of our inner dialogue is this constant reaction to experience by a selfish, childish protagonist. None of us has moved very far from the 7-year-old who vigilantly watches to see who got more. There were also delightful passages about the human tendency to lurch headlong from one pleasurable experience to the next without ever achieving satisfaction. Epstein totally nailed my habit of hunting around my plate for the next bite before I'd tasted what was in my mouth. As he described it, I do not want to experience the fading of the flavor, the colorless, cottony pulp that succeeds that spectacular burst over my taste buds. Prior to reading Epstein, my most substantial interaction with Buddhism was when, as a 15-year-old punk kid, I stole a Buddha statue from a local gardening store and put it in my bedroom because I thought it looked cool. Despite the fact that I was now a religion reporter, I still had only a glancing understanding of this faith. With Buddhists comprising only about 1/300th of the U.S. population and not being in the habit of taking strident political stands, they didn't attract much coverage. What I knew of Buddhism was limited to the following. It was from Asia somewhere, the Buddha was overweight, and his followers believed in things like karma, rebirth, and enlightenment. Epstein made clear, though, that you didn't have to buy into any of the above to derive benefit from Buddhism. The Buddha himself didn't claim to be a god or a prophet. He specifically told people not to adopt any of his teachings until they'd test-driven the material themselves. He wasn't even trying to start a religion, per se. The word Buddhism was actually an invention of the 19th century Western scholars who discovered and translated the original texts. As best as I could tell, the whole thing appeared to be less a faith than a philosophy, and one that had been intriguing psychologists since the days of Freud, when his early Viennese followers studied those newly translated texts. In recent decades, the mental health community had come to embrace Buddhism in an increasingly thoroughgoing way. According to Epstein, the Buddha may well have been the original psychoanalyst. To my surprise, Epstein seemed to be arguing that Buddhism was better than seeing a shrink. Therapy, he said, often leads to understanding without relief. Even Freud himself had conceded that the best therapy could do was bring us from hysteric misery to common unhappiness. Epstein's frank admissions about the limitations of therapy tracked with my personal experiences. I was, of course, grateful to Dr. Brotman for getting me to quit drugs and then steadfastly but affably making sure I stayed the course. I was also fond of him personally, especially for his ability to point out my idiosyncrasies and hypocrisies. However, I still had that nagging and perhaps naive sense of disappointment that he had failed to come up with some sort of unifying theory to explain my entire psychology. Now, Epstein seemed to be saying that even if Brotman had ripped the cover off some primordial wound, it wouldn't have left me better off. The limitation wasn't my therapist, Epstein seemed to be arguing. It was therapy. So what exactly was this not-quite-religion that could purportedly do a better job of salving the tortured soul? I attacked the question the way I would a major investigative news story, learning everything I could. I bought a ton of books, adding them next to the already precarious stack of self-help tomes on my bedside table, a tableau Bianca often insisted on covering up when we had company. According to the official story, the Buddha was born about 500 years before Christ in northeast India in what is now Nepal. As legend has it, his mother was spontaneously impregnated in what sounded like the Buddhist version of the Immaculate Conception. She died 7 days after the birth, leaving the boy, whose name was Siddhartha, to be raised by his father, a regional king. The king had been advised by a local wise man that Siddhartha would grow up to either be a powerful monarch or a great spiritual leader. Eager to ensure that the boy would one day take the throne, the king arranged to have him confined to the palace walls, protected from the outside world and anything that might trigger his mystical tendencies. At age 29, however, Siddhartha grew curious, ran away from home, and became a wandering monk. This was a pretty common practice back in those days. Penniless renunciates with shaved heads, bare feet, and tattered robes would roam the forests seeking spiritual awakening. The prince did this for 6 years until one night he sat under a Bodhi tree, vowing not to get up until he'd achieved enlightenment. At dawn, the man, formerly known as Siddhartha, opened his eyes and gazed out at the world as the Buddha, the awakened one. For a skeptic, there was obviously a lot not to like in this story. However, the substance of what the Buddha allegedly realized beneath the Bodhi tree and then began disseminating to his followers was fascinating, illuminating, and once again appeared to have been crafted by someone who had spent a great deal of time inside my brain. As best I could understand it, the Buddha's main thesis was that in a world where everything is constantly changing, we suffer because we cling to things that won't last. A central theme of the Buddha's Dharma, which roughly translates into teaching, revolved around the very word that had been wafting through my consciousness when I used to lie on my office couch pondering the unpredictability of television news, impermanence. The Buddha embraced an often overlooked truism. Nothing lasts, including us. We and everyone we love will die. Fame fizzles, beauty fades, continents shift, pharaohs are swallowed by emperors who fall to sultans, kings, kaisers, and presidents, and it all plays out against the backdrop of an infinite universe in which our bodies are made up of atoms from the very first exploding stars. We may know this intellectually, but on an emotional level, we seem hardwired for denial. We comport ourselves as if we had solid ground beneath our feet, as if we had control. We quarantine the elderly in nursing homes and pretend aging will never happen to us. We suffer because we get attached to people and possessions that ultimately evaporate. When we lose our hair, when we can no longer score that hit of adrenaline from a war zone we so crave, we grow anxious and make bad decisions. Unlike many of the faiths I'd come across as a religion reporter, the Buddha wasn't promising salvation in the form of some death-defying dogma, but rather through the embrace of the very stuff that will destroy us. The route to true happiness, he argued, was to achieve a visceral understanding of impermanence, which would take you off the emotional roller coaster and allow you to see your dramas and desires through a wider lens. Waking up to the reality of our situation allows you to, as the Buddhists say, let go, to drop your attachments. As one Buddhist writer put it, the key is to recognize the wisdom of insecurity. That phrase, the wisdom of insecurity, really struck me. It was the perfect rejoinder to my price of security motto. It made me see my work worries in an entirely different light. If there was no such thing as security, then why bother with the insecurity? For 2,500 years, the Buddhists had been comprehensively mapping the mind, that tasteless, odorless, formless thing, or more accurately, no thing, through which we experience our entire lives. They compiled meticulous lists. The three characteristics of all phenomena, the four noble truths, the four highest emotions, the seven factors of enlightenment, etc. They also came up with names for so many of the mental habits I'd come to notice in myself, such as comparing mind and wanting mind. They had a term, too, for that thing I did where something would bother me and I would immediately project forward to an unpleasant future, e.g., balding, unemployment, flophouse. The Buddhists called this prapancha, which roughly translates to proliferation or the imperialistic tendency of mind. That captured it beautifully, I thought. Something happens, I worry, and that concern instantaneously colonizes my future. My favorite Buddhist catchphrase, however, was the one they used to describe the churning of the ego, monkey mind. I've always been a sucker for animal metaphors, and I thought this one was perfect. Our minds are like furry little gibbons, always agitated, never at rest. As compelling as the Buddhist view was for me, though, it once again threw me back up against the same old questions I've been wrestling with since the days of Eckhart Tolle. Wasn't the Buddhist emphasis on letting go a recipe for passivity? Was the denigration of desire another way of saying we shouldn't bother to strive? Furthermore, shouldn't we be attached to our loved ones? There were other things I didn't get. If Buddhism was about being happier, why was the Buddha's signature declaration, life is suffering? Then, of course, there was still the issue of enlightenment. The Buddha's claim, which as far as I could tell, modern Buddhists, including Dr. Epstein, still believed, was that it was possible to achieve the end of suffering, to reach nirvana. I couldn't very well mock Tolle for his claims of spiritual awakening and give the Buddhists a pass on enlightenment. Notwithstanding my confusion, the more I learned about the 2,500-year-old historical figure known to me previously as a lawn ornament, the more intrigued I grew. I felt like I was finally onto something truly substantial. This wasn't just the doctrine of one weird German dude, but an ancient tradition that was given serious credence by smart people like Epstein. My hitherto haphazard quest suddenly felt infinitely more directed. Right in the middle of our wedding reception, I decided to make a conscious effort to put everything I was learning about Buddhism to work. Dinner had been served and consumed, and the dancing was underway. That's when we heard it, the swell of horns in the distance. Marching in were about eight Bahamians, all dressed in elaborate local costumes and playing trumpets, trombones, tubas, and drums. It was what islanders call a junkanoo rush. It took me a minute to recognize the song, U2's I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. Perhaps not the best sentiment for a wedding, I thought, but never mind, the music was beautiful and our guests were going wild. I grabbed Bianca, who was looking incandescent in her dress, and we formed a conga line behind the band. I was fully present, totally in the moment, no clinging. I knew this wouldn't last, and I was wringing every bit of pleasure out of it while I could. I had always kind of assumed that I might not enjoy my own wedding. These events were all about the bride, I thought. The groom was just supposed to stand there smiling. I also feared that after a lifetime of avoiding commitment, I would experience some significant last-minute jitters. As usual, my powers of prognostication were completely off. It turned out to be the best weekend of my life. Admittedly, this was a hard place to be unhappy. We were getting married on Harbor Island, a magical spot where most people drove around in golf carts instead of cars, and where free-range chickens were given right-of-way in the streets. The wedding was a small affair, just 50 people, our nuclear families, and our closest friends. Everyone came for 3 days. During the day, people lounged on the beach, where the sand was literally pink, and every night we threw a party. Instead of the usual flybys that most newlyweds do on receiving lines and at guests' tables, Bianca and I got plenty of FaceTime with everyone. I was also buoyed by my confidence that I was making the right decision. I couldn't imagine marrying anyone other than Bianca. As my friend Regina had quipped, "For a person with terrible judgment, you did a great job with the most important decision of your life." But there was something else at work here, too. My consumption of Buddhist books was paying off. Throughout the weekend, I made a deliberate effort to pause, look around, and savor things while they lasted. There were little moments, like running errands for Bianca, for example, putting her carefully curated gift bags in people's rooms and actually enjoying it, or when I babysat my adorable big-eyed baby niece Campbell in my room while everyone else was out having lunch. She sat on my lap and cooed contentedly while I ate a cheeseburger, trying not to drip ketchup on her head. There were big moments, too, like the ceremony itself, where I watched Bianca walk down the aisle and wondered how I'd gotten so lucky. As soon as I got home from the honeymoon, though, my penchant for worry reasserted itself, provoked by a conundrum at work that I simply could not figure out how to handle in a Buddhist way. One Friday evening, I looked up at the TV in my office and saw David Muir anchoring World News, the weekday version, the big show. He was doing a fantastic job, which threw me into a triple Lindy of comparing mind, monkey mind, and propuncha. Muir is kicking ass right now. I'm going down. I was feeling badly, and then, on top of that, feeling badly about feeling badly. I liked the guy, after all. This incident, again, crystallized all of my nagging questions about Buddhism. Doesn't competitiveness serve a useful purpose? Is the price of security simply incompatible with the wisdom of insecurity? It was time for me to play my trump card. Despite the fact that more than 50% of Americans tell pollsters they don't trust the media, generally speaking, people return our calls. I found Mark Epstein's office number and left him a message saying I was a reporter and also a fan. I asked if he'd be willing to meet up, and he called me back right away to say he was game. So about a week later, roughly 8 months after I'd first discovered Eckhart Tolle, I took a cab downtown for my man date with the Buddhist shrink at the Tribeca Grand just a few blocks from his office, the same Shishi Hotel where I'd stayed in the days after 9/11. It was an oddly cool spot for two guys meeting to discuss Eastern spirituality. When I arrived, Epstein was already at the bar, located in the atrium with 7 floors looming overhead. He'd aged a bit since the picture on the back of his books, but I still recognized him, and he still looked considerably younger than his 55 years. His hair, which he wore combed back, was graying, but his hairline was robustly intact. I noticed these things. He was about my height and lean, wearing a slightly oversized blazer with a t-shirt underneath. He greeted me warmly with a voice that had a soft quality to it, perhaps the product of decades in a confined space discussing people's most private and painful issues. After the preliminaries, the ordering of beers, my annoying habit of telling anyone who has a medical degree about the educational pedigrees of my wife and parents, we got down to business. Conditioned as I was by my time with the self-help gurus, I started by asking Epstein flat out whether his life had been radically and grandly transformed by his embrace of Buddhism. For a nanosecond, he looked at me like I was crazy, but then he caught himself. He didn't quite laugh at me, he was too polite for that. Instead, he explained that he, like everyone else, got sad, angry, obsessive, you name it, the entire range of emotions, negative and positive. "Are you always able to stay in the moment?" "Eh, I try to remain aware of my surroundings," he said, but he admitted he didn't always succeed. I pushed him on the Buddhist metaphysics. "Do you believe in reincarnation?" I asked. "It's nice," he said, shrugging his shoulders. This was not a dogmatic individual. It hit me that what I had on my hands here was a previously undiscovered species, a normal human being. Epstein, it appeared to me, was the anti-Tolle, the anti-Chopra, not a guru in the popular sense of the word, just a regular guy with whom I was having a drink on a Friday night. We started to talk about his background. He, too, had grown up in the Boston area. His dad was also a doctor. He didn't have some fancy backstory a la Tolle or Chopra. No sudden late-night spiritual awakening, no hearing of voices. He'd discovered Buddhism after signing up for an Introduction to World Religion course during his freshman year in college because a girl he liked was also in the class. His fling with the girl didn't last, although he did end up dating her roommate, but he did develop an immediate and abiding interest in the Dharma, which resonated with him after a lifelong struggle with feelings of emptiness and unreality and questions about whether he really mattered. I explained to him that I was drawn to Buddhism for the exact opposite reasons. Perhaps unsurprisingly for a man who appeared on television for a living, the question of whether I mattered had never occurred to me. I did not struggle, as Mark did, with feelings of being empty or unreal. On the contrary, I said, only half-jokingly, I feel all too real. I still kind of have a residual suspicion from childhood that the whole world is laid out for my benefit and nothing happens out of my line of sight. Does that place me at a disadvantage in terms of being a Buddhist? He thought this was hilarious. Absolutely not, he said, laughing. Your personality and mine are really different. When I'm thinking about it, it's from a much more introverted place. You're talking from an extroverted place. There's an energy there, an enthusiasm there, a rambunctiousness there. Buddhism, he said, could be helpful for both personality types. I asked what a beginner should do to get deeper into this world. I didn't want to be a Buddhist per se, I just wanted to better manage my ego. He told me how after that initial religion class at Harvard, he had fallen in with a bunch of young people who were also interested in Eastern spirituality. Many of these people had gone on to become influential teachers and writers who'd helped popularize the Dharma in America. He suggested I read some of their books and he started ticking off names. As I madly typed notes into my BlackBerry for future reference, it was impossible not to notice that nearly all of these names were Jewish. Goldstein, Goldman, Kornfield, Salzburg. This is a whole subculture, he said. The little cabal even had a nickname, the Jubus. It sounded like a remarkable group. They had all met at elite Northeast universities and also while taking exotic, druggy romps through the subcontinent. Mark theorized that many of these young Jewish people, having been raised in secular environments, felt a spiritual hole in their lives. He also acknowledged that the Jewish penchant for anxiety probably played a role in their collective attraction to Buddhism. Over the ensuing decades, the Jubus had been a major force in figuring out how to translate the wisdom of the East for a Western audience, mostly by making it less hierarchical and devotional. Mark mentioned that he and some of his peers taught Buddhist-themed seminars around town where they gave talks and answered questions. Go to some events, he advised, until you get bored. I laughed. I liked this guy. This man whose picture I had reflexively rejected turned out to be somebody with whom I could see myself being friends. We were a bit of an odd pair, to be sure, but there was a certain compatibility, too. He was a professional listener, I was a professional talker. We both had the Boston, New York, Jewish cultural affinity thing. He didn't feel foreign like Tolle and Chopra. He could have been one of my uncles. I wanted to be his friend, but what I really wanted was to figure out how to get what he appeared to have. Not some self-conscious, allegedly unbreakable equanimity, but a quiet confidence and easy charm. There was no denial of his neuroses. He seemed to find them amusing rather than enervating. Normally, at this point in the conversation, at least with a Tolle or a Chopra, I'd have been asking for practical advice and, in return, getting a blizzard of non-answers. Mark, however, had a very explicit prescription. This is where the Buddhists diverged quite dramatically from self-help. They had an actual practical program. It wasn't expensive gym crackery, no spendy seminars, no credit cards required. It was totally free. It was a radical internal jujitsu move that was supposed to allow you to face the asshole in your head directly and peacefully disarm him. Problem was, I found what they were proposing to be repellent. Chapter 6, The Power of Negative Thinking. My abiding distaste for anything associated with hippies or the New Age dates back to the mid-1970s when I was about 5 years old. My parents, still not having sloughed off the cultural residue of the Age of Aquarius, sent me to a children's yoga class at a local elementary school. I showed up wearing Tough Skins, the indestructible children's jeans that had been recently introduced by Sears. The teacher, who looms in my memory like an airy fairy praying mantis, pronounced my pants to be insufficiently flexible for the exercises we'd be doing. In front of all the other little kids, she made me strip down and do sun salutations in my tidy whities. My early childhood traumas, which also included compulsory camping trips and visits to musty health food stores, were compounded by my years at Colby College, a small liberal arts school in central Maine, where I was repeatedly forced to listen to Jerry Garcia's interminable guitar noodling by hacky sack playing, do-rag and Tiva-wearing deadheads from the suburbs of Massachusetts and Connecticut. All of which left me in a tricky position vis-a-vis Buddhism. Epstein et al. Argued that the only way to tame the monkey mind, to truly glimpse impermanence and defeat our habitual tendency toward clinging, was to meditate, and I had absolutely no intention of following their advice. Meditation struck me as the distillation of everything that sucked hardest about the granola lifestyle. I pictured myself seated in an unbearable cross-legged position, my disavowal of yoga having left me less limber than I would have liked, in a room that smelled like feet with a group of smug practitioners ringing bells, ogling crystals, intoning om, and attempting to float off into some sort of cosmic goo. My attitude was summed up nicely by Alec Baldwin's character on 30 Rock, who said, "Meditation is a waste of time, like learning French or kissing after sex." Compounding my resistance was my extremely limited attention span, another of the many reasons I went into TV. I assumed there was no way my particular mind, worrying at best, at worst a whirlwind, could ever stop thinking. This stalemate between the Dharma and me might have dragged on indefinitely, but then a month after my mandate with Epstein, I happened to go see my shrink. I was reluctant to tell Dr. Brotman about my budding interest in Buddhism because, like me, he had an aversion to sloppy sentimentality. It's part of why we were simpatico. But when I fessed up, he responded by telling me about a former colleague of his from Harvard who had written a best-selling book about the health benefits of meditation. Brotman seemed to think it might do me some good. "Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not for me," I said. Then, as I sat there, absorbing his surprising response, I recalled aloud how, on the first day we met, he had used an animal analogy to explain how someone like me needed to not only refrain from drugs, but also engage in careful mental and physical upkeep in order to stay balanced. "When you say you think meditation might be good for me, is that because of the time you told me I needed to treat myself like a stallion?" He started laughing and shaking his head. "I never said stallion, I said thoroughbred." Whatever, semantics. I went ahead and read the book Brotman was referring to by his friend. This doctor's theory was that in modern life, our ancient fight-or-flight mechanism was being triggered too frequently, in traffic jams, meetings with our bosses, etc., and that this was contributing to the epidemic of heart disease. Even if the confrontations were themselves minor, our bodies didn't know that. They reacted as if they were in kill-or-be-killed scenarios, releasing toxic stress chemicals into the bloodstream. The doctor had done studies showing that meditation could reverse the effects of stress and lower blood pressure, which the hypochondriac in me found deeply appealing. I then read a few books about what Buddhist meditation actually involved and learned that you didn't need to wear robes, chant Sanskrit phrases, or listen to Cat Stevens. Perhaps my attitude on this matter was yet another example of my reaching hasty conclusions. My resistance was starting to crack. St. Paul, the notorious murderer of Christians, had a conversion experience on the road to Damascus. Nixon, the devout anti-communist, electrified the world by traveling to China. The sudden renunciation of everything one has previously stood for is a well-established part of the human repertoire. Mine came in a stolen moment on the floor of a beach house. It was the last weekend in August, and Bianca and I were sharing a big old converted barn with a group of friends. The people we were leasing it from, a pair of retired college professors, had rather idiosyncratically decorated the place with antique farm equipment, including sickles, axes, and pitchforks, which were hanging precariously from the rafters and from pretty much every inch of wall space. In addition to the elaborate arrays of saws, scissors, and hammers, there was a barrel filled with wooden rakes. One afternoon, I was out by the pool, after having just finished reading yet another book about Buddhist meditation. The thought popped into my head, should I try this? I was in a weakened state, tenderized by the scientific evidence and with my reference points for normalcy scrambled by months of marinating in Buddhism, I decided, damn it, let's give it a shot, carpe diem and whatnot. While my housemates clearly had a high tolerance for kitsch, given their willingness to live in a house called Barn Again, I was not at all sure they were open-minded about meditation, and I had no desire to find out. I sneaked off to our bedroom to give it a try. The instructions were reassuringly simple. 1. Sit comfortably. You don't have to be cross-legged. Plop yourself in a chair, on a cushion, on the floor, wherever. Just make sure your spine is reasonably straight. 2. Feel the sensations of your breath as it goes in and out. Pick a spot, nostrils, chest, or gut. Focus your attention there and really try to feel the breath. If it helps to direct your attention, you can use a soft mental note like in and out. 3. This one, according to all of the books I'd read, was the biggie. Whenever your attention wanders, just forgive yourself and gently come back to the breath. You don't need to clear the mind of all thinking. That's pretty much impossible. True, when you are focused on the feeling of your breath, the chatter will momentarily cease, but this won't last too long. The whole game is to catch your mind wandering and then come back to the breath over and over again. I sat on the floor with my back up against the bed and my legs sprawled out in front of me. I set the alarm on my BlackBerry to go off in 5 minutes and let rip. In. Out. In. Shrubbery. I like that word. Why, from an evolutionary standpoint, do we like the smell of our own filth? Get in the game, dude. In. Out. My butt hurts. Let me shift a little bit here. In. Idea for old-school hip-hop show. Rap Van Winkle. Now I have an itch on the ball of my left foot. Where did gerbils run wild? Would I describe myself more as a baller or a shot caller? What was the best thing before sliced bread? And so it went until the alarm went off, by which point it felt like an eternity had passed. When I opened my eyes, I had an entirely different attitude about meditation. I didn't like it, per se, but I now respected it. This was not just some hippie time-passing technique like Ultimate Frisbee or making God's eyes. It was a rigorous brain exercise, rep after rep of trying to tame the runaway train of the mind. The repeated attempt to bring the compulsive thought machine to heel was like holding a live fish in your hand, wrestling your mind to the ground, repeatedly hauling your attention back to the breath in the face of the inner onslaught required genuine grit. This was a badass endeavor. I resolved to do it every day. I started getting up a little early each morning and banging out 10 minutes sitting on the floor of our living room with my back up against the couch. When I was on the road, I meditated on the floor of hotel rooms. It didn't get any easier. Almost immediately upon sitting down, I'd be beset by itches. Then there was the fatigue, a thick ooze, a sludge-like torpor sliding down my forehead. Even when the itches and fatigue lifted, I was left contending with the unstoppable fire hose of thoughts. Focusing on the breath as a way to temporarily stop the thinking was like using a broom to sweep a floor crawling with cockroaches. You could clear the space briefly, but then the bugs came marauding back in. I knew I was supposed to just forgive myself, but I found that to be extremely difficult. Every time I got lost in thought, I went into a mini shame spiral. My wanderings were so tawdry and banal. Is this really what I was thinking about all the time? Lunch? Whether I needed a haircut? My unresolved anger at the Academy for awarding Best Picture to Dances with Wolves instead of Goodfellas? When I wasn't lost in random musings, I was obsessing about how much time was left, dying for the ordeal to be over. It was like that Simpsons episode where they showed the world record holder for longest consecutive case of hiccups. In between hiccups, she would say, "Kill me." By the end of 10 minutes, my jaw was often gritted from the effort. It reminded me of how one of our cats, Steve, who had a serious gum disease, would sometimes literally try to run away from himself when he was in pain. Similarly, when the alarm would go off at the end of a meditation session, I would often bolt out of my seated position as if I could somehow physically escape the commotion of my own mind. There were always happy, round-faced statues of the Buddha out front at airport spas and Chinese restaurants. Although I had come to learn that the Laughing Buddha is actually a medieval Chinese monk who somehow became conflated in the Western imagination with the historical Buddha, who only ate one meal a day and was most likely a bag of skin and bones. His image was bedazzled onto t-shirts sold in the gift shop at my gym. The word Zen had become synonymous with mellow. But this was all false advertising. Buddhist meditation was diabolically hard. Despite its difficulties, though, meditation did offer something huge, an actual method for shutting down the monkey mind, if only for a moment. It was like tricking the furry little gibbon, distracting it with something shiny so it would sit still. Unlike Tolle, who offered very little by way of actionable advice, meditation presented a real remedy, a temporary escape route from the clammy embrace of self-obsession. It may have been miserable, but it was the best and only solution I'd heard yet. Pretty quickly, my efforts began to bear fruit off the cushion, to use a Buddhist term of art. I started to be able to use the breath to jolt myself back to the present moment, in airport security lines, waiting for elevators, you name it. I found it to be a surprisingly satisfying exercise. Life became a little bit like walking into a familiar room where all the furniture had been rearranged. And I was much better at forgiving myself out in the real world than while actually meditating. Every moment was an opportunity for a do-over, a million mulligans. Meditation was radically altering my relationship to boredom, something I'd spent my whole life scrambling to avoid. The only advice I ever got from my college advisor, a novelist of minor renown named James Boylan, who later had a sex change operation, changed his name to Jenny, wrote a best-selling book, and appeared on Oprah, was to never go anywhere without something to read. I diligently heeded that guidance, taking elaborate precautions to make sure every spare moment was filled with distraction. I scanned my BlackBerry at stoplights, brought reams of work research to read in the doctor's waiting room, and watched videos on my iPhone while riding in taxicabs. Now I started to see life's in-between moments, sitting at a red light, waiting for my crew to get set up for an interview, as a chance to focus on my breath or just take in my surroundings. As soon as I began playing this game, I really noticed how much sleepwalking I did, how powerfully my mind propelled me forward or backward. Mostly, I saw the world through a scrim of skittering thoughts, which created a kind of buffer between me and reality. As one Buddhist author put it, the craving to be otherwise, to be elsewhere, permeated my whole life. The net effect of meditation, plus trying to stay present during my daily life, was striking. It was like anchoring myself to an underground aquifer of calm. It became a way to steel myself as I moved through the world. On Sunday nights, in the seconds right before the start of world news, I would take a few deep breaths and look around the room, out at the milling stage crew, up at the ceiling rigged with lights, grounding myself in reality before launching into the unreality of bellowing into a camera with unseen millions behind it. All of this was great, of course, but as it turns out, it wasn't actually the main point. Buddhism's secret sauce went by a hopelessly anodyne name, mindfulness. In a nutshell, mindfulness is the ability to recognize what is happening in your mind right now, anger, jealousy, sadness, the pain of a stubbed toe, whatever, without getting carried away by it. According to the Buddha, we have three habitual responses to everything we experience. We want it, reject it, or we zone out. Cookies, I want. Mosquitoes, I reject. The safety instructions the flight attendants read aloud on an airplane, I zone out. Mindfulness is a fourth option, a way to view the contents of our mind with non-judgmental remove. I found this theory elegant, but utterly unfeasible. On the cushion, the best opportunities to learn mindfulness are when you experience itches or pain. Instead of scratching or shifting position, you're supposed to just sit there and impartially witness the discomfort. The instruction is simply to employ what the teachers call noting, applying a soft mental label, itching, itching, or throbbing, throbbing. For me, this was infernally difficult. A dagger-like tingle would appear under my thigh, a little pinprick portal to Hades, and I would grit my teeth and question the choices I was making in life. I couldn't suspend judgment. I hated it. The idea is that once you've mastered things like itches, eventually you'll be able to apply mindfulness to thoughts and emotions, This non-judgmental noting, oh, that's a blast of self-pity, oh, that's me ruminating about work, is supposed to sap much of the power, the emotional charge, out of the contents of consciousness. It was easy to see how scalable mindfulness could be. For instance, it'd be late in the day and I'd get a call from the World News Rim telling me the story I'd spent hours scrambling to produce was no longer going to air in tonight's show. My usual response was to think to myself, I'm angry. Reflexively, I would then fully inhabit that thought and actually become angry. I would then give the person on the other end of the line some unnecessary chin music, even though I knew intellectually that they usually had a very good reason for killing the piece. In the end, I was left feeling bad about having expended energy on a story that didn't air, and also feeling guilty for having been needlessly salty. The point of mindfulness was to short-circuit what had always been a habitual, mindless chain reaction. Once I started thinking about how this whole system of seemingly spontaneous psychological combustion worked, I realized how blindly impaled even, I was by my ego. I spent so much time, as one Buddhist writer put it, drifting unaware on a surge of habitual impulses. This is what led me to the misadventures of war, drugs, and panic. It's what propelled me to eat when I wasn't hungry or get snippy with Bianca because I was stewing about something that happened at the office. Mindfulness represented an alternative to living reactively. This was not some mental parlor trick. Mindfulness is an inborn trait, a birthright. It is, one could argue, what makes us human. Taxonomically, we are classified as Homo sapiens sapiens, the man who thinks and knows he thinks. Our minds have this other capability, a bonus level, to put it in gamer speak, that no one tells us about in school. Not here in the West, at least. We can do more than just think. We also have the power simply to be aware of things without judgment, without the ego. This is not to denigrate thinking, just to say that thinking without awareness can be a harsh master. By way of example, you can be mindful of hunger pangs, but you think about where to get your next meal and whether it will involve pork products. You can be mindful of the pressure in your bladder telling you it's time to pee, but you think about whether the frequency of your urination means you're getting old and need a prostate exam. There is a difference between the raw sensations we experience and the mental spinning we do in reaction to said stimuli. The Buddhists had a helpful analogy here. Picture the mind like a waterfall, they said. The water is the torrent of thoughts and emotions. Mindfulness is the space behind the waterfall. Again, elegant theory, but easier said than done. There were many areas of my life in which I badly needed this mindfulness thing. Eating, for example. After quitting drugs, food became my replacement dopamine rush. Once I met Bianca, the situation got worse because I was also happy and homebound. She would cook large meals of pasta, followed by fresh-baked cookies. For a bantamweight, I could crush plate after plate. I would tell myself I would be moderate, but once the frenzy started, I couldn't stop. I was feeding the pleasure centers of my brain rather than my stomach, and I was particularly bad with dessert. The fact that my parents never let me have sugar when I was a kid produced a lifelong obsession. The same thing happened with television, ironically. I could eat piles of cookies, my teeth scything through the chewy goodness. Airports were particularly dangerous. Auntie Anne, that seductress, would lure me in with a bouquet of cinnamon sugar sticks. As my paunch grew, it became the source of nearly as much angst as the recession of my hairline. Neither vanity nor mindfulness helped, though. It wasn't uncommon for me to get directly up from meditating and stuff my face, enter into a postprandial remorse jag, and take a nap. But where I really could have used a nice dose of mindfulness was in dealing with the events set in motion after I received a call from Amy Antelis, the Senior Vice President for Talent Development. Amy was in charge of recruiting and managing all the anchors and correspondents. She reached me when I was on my way to the airport for a story. This was in early September of 2009, about a month after I'd started meditating. Amy had big news. Later in the day, she told me, management would announce that Charlie Gibson had decided to step down as the anchor of World News. They would simultaneously announce that Diane Sawyer would be leaving Good Morning America to take over the evenings. This was huge. I was happy for Diane. She'd initially agreed to host GMA a full decade ago on a temporary basis, but she'd performed so well that the bosses repeatedly cajoled her into sticking around. Now, the brightest star in our news division would be ascending to the big chair, a promotion many of us felt she richly deserved. It didn't take long, though, for me to shift into what does it all mean for me mode. This announcement would surely set off an avalanche of a magnitude akin to what happened after Peter Jennings died. Many dominoes were about to fall. Diane's departure from the mornings meant the brass would probably have to remake the anchor team on GMA, which would have ripple effects throughout the on-air ranks. What was coming was a radical reshuffling of the dramatis personae. I had been anchoring world news on Sundays for about 4 years now, and I still loved it, but if new jobs were going to be opening up, I wanted in. My desire for forward momentum, even when the lack thereof was illusory, roughly resembled that of Woody Allen in that classic scene from Annie Hall where he breaks up with Diane Keaton. A relationship, I think, is like a shark, he says. It has to constantly move forward or it dies. And I think what we got on our hands is a dead shark. Not long after the Gibson-Sawyer news, the situation intensified. We got word of two other departures. John Stossel, the co-anchor of 2020, and Martin Bashir, one of the three anchors of Nightline. The latter development was of especial interest to me. After years of working as a correspondent on Nightline, I had begun making it known that I would love to join the staff as an anchor. It seemed like the perfect job for me, the type of gig I could ride all the way to retirement. I genuinely enjoyed the rush of crashing short pieces for GMA and World News, especially in breaking news situations, but these stories were basically haikus, 90 to 120-second long recitations of the day's events. On Nightline, the pieces ran anywhere from 4 to 8 minutes. If the story was really good, they might give you the entire half hour. It wasn't just the length of the stories that I liked, but also the variety. The show matched my small-c Catholic interests. On any given night, they were as likely to do a hard-hitting investigation as they were a profile of a movie star or a story about doggy fat camps. In recent months, Nightline had given me even more chances to slake my thirst for comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. I'd gone off searching for endangered tree kangaroos in Papua New Guinea, hunting down American sex tourists in Cambodia, and confronting pastors in the Congo who made money by convincing parents to submit their children to painful exorcisms. Problem was, there was another contender, Bill Weir, the weekend GMA anchor. Bill had joined ABC News in 2004 from the local affiliate in Los Angeles where he was the sports guy. He exuded an old-school and sometimes brooding cool. Notwithstanding his lack of hard news pedigree, Bill very quickly established himself as an excellent journalist, covering major breaking news as well as producing amazingly inventive feature stories. My favorite example of the latter was Bill's profile of Don LaFontaine, the guy who did all the voiceovers for movie trailers. LaFontaine's voice was so deep that when he delivered his classic lines, "In a world," it sounded like he had a third testicle. Instead of just doing a traditional sit-down interview, Bill had LaFontaine follow him around L.A., narrating his life through a handheld microphone. The best scene took place at an outdoor cafe where Bill was nonchalantly eyeballing the menu. LaFontaine, he's the world's deadliest assassin. His identity is a secret even from himself. This summer, love gets lethal. Weir, I'm thinking about getting an omelet. LaFontaine, I'm thinking about getting a salad. Weir, is it too early for a salad? Cut to a close-up of LaFontaine, it's never too early for a salad. It was gingerly suggested to me by the bosses that perhaps I should also consider the possibility of moving into Bill's spot on Weekend GMA if he got the nod for Nightline. Initially, I dismissed this as a lateral move, but was ultimately convinced to reconsider. This assignment, I came to realize, would not only quadruple my airtime from a half hour on Sundays to 2 full hours on Saturdays and Sundays, but it would also provide me with a chance to try a different type of broadcasting, to break out of the mold of the staid, Jennings-esque anchorman. Morning television wasn't just one guy and a teleprompter, it was live, loose, and largely unscripted. Moreover, mornings were where the action was in network news. GMA had the younger viewers that advertisers wanted to reach, which made the show the profit center for the entire news division. I said I was up for it, but made it clear that my first choice was still Nightline. I was now in the tricky position of arguing for both jobs simultaneously, and neither was a lock. I kept picturing the worst possible outcomes. Prepuncia in full effect. No promotion, eventually lose my hair, and as a consequence, all future job prospects, Flophouse in Duluth. I was granted an audience with David Weston, where I would be given a chance to plead my case. At the appointed hour, I walked one flight up from my office to the fifth floor. After the requisite wait on the couch outside his office, I was whisked inside by his secretary and greeted by David's wide grin and firm handshake. He listened politely as I made my case, first for Nightline, then for GMA. He asked some smart questions, which I answered to the best of my ability. I thought I did okay, but it was hard to tell. Like all skilled managers, David was a master at uttering a lot of words without actually committing himself to a position. I knew not to push too hard to minimize the displays of plumage. Anyone's affability can turn brittle under too much pressure. Our business concluded, the rest of the meeting moved on to non-work issues. Here, things became very relaxed. There was banter and badinage, and I left feeling deceptively buoyant. This lasted about 90 seconds. By the time I'd made it downstairs to my office, I had thoroughly soured. Given a moment to reflect, I realized that David had said absolutely nothing concrete or reassuring. In fact, I came away with the vague sense that he was going to pass me over. Worse, I knew it was possible that he wouldn't make his decision for quite a while. If ever there was a good time to see if I could summon some mindfulness, this seemed like it. I tried meditating on the couch in my office, but it didn't work. I just couldn't clamber up behind the waterfall. Every time I tried to watch my thoughts, to non-judgmentally observe my frustration over this professional limbo, I didn't know what to look for or how to look at it. Wasn't noting just another form of thinking? What the hell am I supposed to be seeing here? And wait a minute, wasn't there a practical value to disquiet? Just because my thoughts didn't have any inherent reality didn't preclude them from being connected to real-world problems that needed to be dealt with. Here I was back at square one, pondering the same questions I'd been pondering since first reading Eckhart Tolle. I was still unshakably certain that looking at a problem from all angles and searching for the right move gave me an edge. And yet I was also still concerned that too much worrying was driving me nuts. I spent the ensuing weeks in a bit of a funk. I tried to note it, but I didn't know if I was being mindful or just indulging it. I decided it was time to follow a piece of advice from my new friend, Mark Epstein. The event was held in a huge, nondescript function hall at the Sheraton Towers in Midtown Manhattan, and as soon as I got there, I regretted it. The place had all the charm of an off-track betting parlor. It was packed with mostly middle-aged women wearing dangly earrings and intricately arranged scarves. Any one of them could have been the yoga teacher who made me strip down to my underwear as a child. I'd seen worse, of course, in the self-help trenches, but this was different. I was here at this three-day Buddhist conference not as a journalistic observer, but as a paying customer who'd come for his own personal purposes, a thought that propelled just the tiniest bit of vomit into my mouth. Making matters worse, this was proving to be very embarrassing in front of a new friend of mine who I'd roped into coming along. His name was Jason. He was the drummer for one of my favorite bands, Mates of State. They were a husband and wife indie act who wrote infectious pop songs about suburban angst. I had done a feature story on them for Sunday World News, focusing on how they took their two young children on tour and wrote a blog about it called Band on the Diaper Run. After the story aired, Bianca and I struck up a friendship with Jason and his wife, Corey. Jason was one of the few people to whom I had successfully evangelized about Buddhism. Interestingly, he voiced a concern about meditation that seemed to be a corollary to my ongoing security-insecurity conundrum. He worried that if he became too happy, it would defang his angst and disable his ability to write music. A comedy writer friend of mine had said something similar, that he was worried meditation would make him less judgmental and therefore less funny. Here in the hall, Jason, who was 6'3", had fashionably long bangs and could pull off wearing skinny jeans, stood out like a sore thumb. I had been talking up Mark Epstein to Jason for months, and now Mark was up on the stage, seated alongside two other Buddhist teachers, presiding over this horror show. The opening speaker was a woman in her 50s named Tara Brock. She had long brown hair and pleasant Semitic features. She was holding forth in a creamy,